Welcome to Safety Spectrum, your environmental health and safety connection. This program is a presentation of the Michigan Safety Conference. For almost a century, the annual conference has provided credible educational opportunities and valuable support to the safety and health practitioner by offering 120 instructional programs, along with exhibits highlighting the latest in safety equipment, instrumentation, and demonstrations. To learn more about the conference, please find us at MICH safetyconference.org.
Welcome to Safety Spectrum. I'm your host, Sheila Eide. This program is sponsored by the Michigan Safety Conference. Our topic today is emergency planning. Are you prepared? With my guest, Tracy Hazel. There is a saying that failure to plan is planning to fail. What should we be considering when identifying risk? Ranking probability to the extent of the disaster is a tricky business. For example, the greatest emergency in the airline industry would be a plane crash. Low probability, but everybody dies. Our guest, Tracy Hazel, has been the owner of Advanced Training and Consulting since 2007. Before that, she was part of the EHS team at General Motors and the Health and Safety Director for the American Red Cross. At Advanced Training, Tracy consults on safety and health programs with general industry, construction, and government businesses. She's also an OSHA outreach instructor for general industry and construction and a variety of topics. Thank you for joining me today, Tracy.
Thank you, Sheila. Thanks for having me today. I think that what we plan to talk about, emergency planning, can really affect everyone in all walks of businesses and even in our homes. So I really appreciate the opportunity to come on today and talk to you about this important topic.
I'm glad you mentioned also personal safety is part of emergency planning as well in our homes and that. How long has OSHA been around, and my OSHA, I guess, for Michigan? And were there some incidents that happened in the history that raised concern that people don't have good safety and health programs?
Well, I think some people might be surprised that OSHA has not been around really for all that long. For some of us, we were born prior to the date that it all got started. But OSHA has been around since the early 70s, 1970, 71. And prior to that, we really did not have any uniform health and safety rules, responsibilities, standards. But most importantly, we couldn't hold employers accountable for employee safety for the most part. There are lots of incidents within the United States where it's been pivotal. One that I speak about often in my OSHA 10 and 30 classes is the 1911 New York Shirtwaist Factory. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with this, Sheila, but in this incident, the factory caught on fire, and all of the managers and supervisors and people of importance basically told the workers, you know, there's a fire in the building, but we need you to keep working. And they left and ended up locking and chaining all of those employees in the building. And as a result, there were literally over 100 people, mostly women and children, that either burned to death in the building or jumped from the roof of that building. And that was a horrific outcry. People were upset, of course. And at that time, there wasn't really anything in place that said we had to keep our employees safe and prepare them for emergencies. And if we look out throughout history in the United States, we have lots of incidents that said, well, you know, if they would have known or if they were prepared, maybe we wouldn't have lost as many people or the property as well. You know, that's an issue.
That was the Triangle Factory shirt fire?
Yeah, so the 1911 New York Shirtwaist Factory fire, that was a pivotal incident in the United States. It happened in New York. And
generally, it was women and children.
Yeah,
wasn't it,
that were killed? Particular incident, I want to say there's roughly 150, 152, primarily women and children. I think there was 12 men that died in that incident during the time we had a lot of women and children. that primarily worked in the factories like that. So
I think it also kind of brought in some laws about child labor. I think that was also a pivotal point in history of not employing children for 12, 14 hours a day. And okay. Also, I'll back up a little bit. OSHA for federal, and then my OSHA, Michigan OSHA, has its own state plan. So the difference there is
so, that. Okay, so OSHA is a federal health and safety program, where here in the state of Michigan, we have our own health and safety state program called MyOSHA. Not all states have their own health and safety state program like Michigan's MyOSHA. And in the absence of having your own health and safety state plan, then the employers and employees would be abiding by the federal OSHA rules strictly. Okay.
So you talked about being held accountable. Maybe can owners be legally liable if they violate health and safety standards or rules?
So absolutely. When OSHA was developed in the 70s, it also set some standards regarding fines and citations that could be levied to the employer. And many times when we hear about an industrial accident or an incident, you'll hear that either OSHA or, in our case here, MyOSHA did an investigation, and as a result, maybe there were some citations or fines that were issued to the employer. Now, I think what's really important for people to know and understand that employers, businesses, business owners could also be held legally responsible in the event that they have an absence of a plan, or they have what's called willful and repeated violations that maybe caused a death on the job, that yes, employers can be held legally and financially responsible.
Is there something called the general duty clause? Is that, that's in the plan with MyOSHA? How does that read?
Okay, so the general duty clause basically states that as an employer, we have a responsibility to keep our employees safe on the job from any known or potential recognizable hazards. So that's where the general duty clause falls in. Now, there are a lot of rules and safety standards for specific job tasks. And when we have an absence of a specific rule and someone gets hurt on the job, often the employer is held to the general duty clause or to that standard or that rule.
And I think the other half of that rule also indicates that the employees are supposed to follow the training that they've been given for safety and health.
Yes. You know, it's our responsibility as employers to do risk assessments and determine what are some of the hazards that may be associated with the work that our workers perform. Part of that is understanding risk probability, and what we need to do as employers to keep our employees safe on the job. Now, employees do have some responsibilities to follow your workers' plans and to participate in training group activities and things like evacuations, that sort of thing. So it's a fine line when we start talking about emergency planning, preparedness and response. Because in my opinion, everyone has a personal responsibility to go home safe at the end of the day.
I think it's an occupational hazard to be in the safety health business is that I can't even go to a restaurant without looking for my exit route, or sitting in a concert or a church and just saying, okay, if there was something happened, how would I leave? How would I get out of here? So that's something we all should be considering, I think.
You know, absolutely, Sheila. That's a prime example. That's something that I was just thinking about over this past weekend. Went into a restaurant. It was a busy place. You know, we had to go three floors up into the dining area, and sitting there and just thinking all of a sudden, you know, where's my closest fire escape, or are there fire extinguishers if something should happen? This actually is a term, it's coined, it's called situational awareness. Is this something that you've heard of before, Sheila? Uh-huh. Situational awareness?
Yes.
Okay. I think this is important to talk about. That's something that is often talked about with active shooter training or workplace violence. Situational awareness is when you are in a space, whether it's your workplace or at a restaurant or a theater, that you have a general idea or overview of how to get out of that place. For example, where are the nearest exits? If there was a medical emergency, do I know where the AED is located, the automated external defibrillator? All these things play a critical role when there's an emergency. And if we are not prepared or have plans in advance, then that's when we see more lives are lost and more property is damaged.
Yeah, I know that I've talked to emergency workers where I say, well, what if everybody calls 911 on the same incident? And I said, it's fine. You can get multiple reports of something. Just don't assume that someone else is taking care of it. You have a responsibility as well. If you're the one calling 911, don't worry if you're the 15th call. It's a good thing. What do you see? You go into a lot of different companies, a lot of different businesses. What do you find are the common or prevalent issues that when you're evaluating a business?
You know, that's a good question, Sheila. You know, when I'm out doing a safety walkthrough or loss control survey, my eyes and ears are open to everything. You know, I have that critical eye and looking for slip, trip, and fall hazards and things of that nature. But one of the most common things that I find with businesses and companies that I work with is that there may not be a fully established, communicated plan for an emergency. There are some rules and regulations when we're talking about OSHA and MyOSHA, what needs to be in writing and what kind of training, you know, your employees need to have prior to working on a job site. But I often find that there's a gap or a lack of communication between those that are maybe writing the safety plan and those that have to live the safety plan. I think there's three ways that a company can be more prepared, and that is to make a communication plan, whether it's put it in writing and pass it out to all your employees. You need to communicate, you know, exit routes, evacuation muster points. So number one, communication is a key and critical issue during an emergency. Imagine that if you had an emergency and you try to use your communication device and there was none and you can't get a hold of anyone. So what's your plan after that? So just being prepared and fully communicate with your employees, I think, is one way to be prepared. Two more, prepare your evacuation plans in a facility and your muster locations. Practice. I often think about this when we talk about lessons learned with the World Trade Center, for example. Most people may not know that the World Trade Center actually was attacked twice. And in the first terrorist attack, there was a bomb that went off in the basement of one of the towers. And during that first incident, it's recorded and it said that it literally took hours for people to evacuate the World Trade Center buildings in that first incident. And through practicing their evacuation plans, their evacuation routes from the first incident to the more notorious second terrorist incident at the World Trade Center on September 11th, 2001, when they practiced these routes and these plans, there's a lot of evidence to support that the people that were able to get out of those buildings were able to get out due to practicing and planning their evacuation routes, having emergency lighting set up in the stairwell, and having a real defined plan that involved practicing the plan. And then the third thing that I would say about being prepared is potentially create an emergency supply kit. I know that certain organizations, I worked for with the American Red Cross as a health and safety director, they're really big on having a plan and having a kit and knowing what you need to have available in the event that something should happen. I think there's a lot of opportunities for us to look at lessons learned across the line when we've had these major incidents throughout the United States, whether it's chemical spills, major fires, active shooters. I mean, we look at the shooting in Las Vegas, for example. That's something, you know, we can't really plan or predict or say that that's going to happen that day. But we should look at all the evidence that supports us to be prepared for the what ifs. What if something should happen? And that topic in itself, just every day, we're seeing more and more workplace violence. We're seeing more active shooters. So does your company have a plan for that? That's what I always look for.
Well, the follow-up question's got to be, do you find most companies are prepared for emergencies?
You know, I think in this conversation, I think it's important to acknowledge those companies that really do a good job at planning and preparing their people. There's lots of them out there. I think these are the places that are very successful, places that retain their employees. But if you look on the opposite end of those companies, the ones that really stand out, I really would beg to say that most companies are not planned or prepared to deal with an emergency. And some may do a really good job on a site-specific hazard. For example, maybe it's a chemical manufacturing facility. Maybe they have really good plans established for one type of emergency at their facility, but are they also planning for a person who may experience a heart attack? Or what if there was, you know, that chemical release and a fire? So I think companies overall could probably do a better job in emergency preparedness.
And say in many cases, they can see what's really obvious, unique to their business, but often they may miss something that they wouldn't think of, that wouldn't think normally happening.
Mm-hmm.
So what type of emergency should we be planning for that may be unique?
You know, this is a really good question. This is a question that I often will pose to my students in classes. And some of the common responses, medical emergencies, fires, of course, we mentioned workplace violence. I often will ask my classes, should Michigan be preparing, you know, for a tsunami?
And a tsunami?
A tsunami, yes. That's the common response that I get from my students, like, no, that, you know, that doesn't really happen here, or that's not a feasible concern or something that was just here in the state of Michigan. And then I think it's really interesting to talk about how actually we have had tsunamis here in Michigan. And quick Google searches will tell you that we have had people here in Michigan that have died from tsunamis on the Great Lakes. And in the West Michigan area, I know our emergency response planners, our FEMA coordinators, have all been on a mission to request additional funding and warning signs and signals for tsunamis in the West Michigan area. And that is one thing I think that surprises a lot of folks here, is that, I guess they're
not. When I've been in Grand Haven, like in the fall or something, and the waves are just crashing over that by the lighthouse. I can't imagine anybody being out on that pier, but they look pretty tall to me. It looks pretty much like you're on the ocean. And I've heard, you know, the lakes are shallower, and in some ways the waves can be higher and bounce the boats around even worse, the freighters and that. I've heard that it's almost worse than the ocean because they're shallow and you get higher waves.
Yeah. You know, what's really interesting, a fun fact about that, if we're talking about Michigan history and tsunamis, ironically, the date July 4th seems to stand out where more Michiganders have lost their lives due to tsunamis. And I know that July 4th weekend is a common date where, you know, we head towards the beaches and maybe we don't think about safety being an issue. Our state history provides that on July 4th, I know this is reaching back, but 1929, we lost people. But as early as 2003, I believe, was the last recorded tsunami in the state of Michigan where people lost their lives. So do we need to plan and prepare for tsunamis? I think that's going to be up to, you know, where are you located? Are you right on the lakeshore? Would this be a concern? In some cases, when we look at water in itself, we can talk about the Midland floods. Lots of property damage. You know, were people prepared, or can you even prepare for something like that? So I think that that's a conversation that we could probably have for a long time, Sheila.
Yeah, that's a good point. That was a terrible disaster, and I don't know who you would hold accountable for that. I think it was a privately owned dams, but it wiped out entire small towns over there and just devastated it. So like you say, as a person in your home, how do you prepare for that? So.
Right. You know, I think that the key driver in this conversation is really for people to think about their own workplaces, to think about your homes and think about the probability, like what could happen. These are things that we know statistically, for example, heart attacks. It's the number one reason why people die in the United States. Statistically, one in three women in the United States dies this way. And unfortunately, there's high consequences of failure if we choose not to respond or act to that. And I think a common reason why people choose not to respond to a heart attack or a situation where someone needs CPR is because they simply just don't know what to do, or they have a fear of doing something wrong. And when we practice and we plan for emergencies, more lives, hands down, are saved.
Yeah, when I was a safety director, I did some training in the Heimlich maneuver and CPR and those type of things for the employee, not for the workplace, but for the benefit of the people. And I had someone come up to me later and say, you know, I didn't want to go through these classes, but she said my son started choking and I remembered what you told us in that class and I was able to get it out what he was choking on. So we don't realize the value that we add to things.
You know, that, you know, I feel that so much when you just said what you said. I feel like sometimes people prepare after the fact, like something happened. A terrible incident happened, a fire happened, a medical emergency. And that's when people start thinking about, wow, maybe we should have trained some people, or maybe we should have communicated our plan on the shop floor, for example. You know, what are we supposed to do? And sometimes, you know, you asked me earlier about businesses and being prepared. I feel like sometimes those that create the written plan, the safety plan, for example, they may feel or know or understand that they have a plan, they have a plan in place, but then there's this gap between the written plan up in the ivory tower and the workers that are actually doing the job that would have to fulfill the plan in the event of an emergency.
So what does OSHA, MyOSHA require to have, what safety procedures need to be in writing?
Okay, well, when we talk about actual requirements that OSHA and MyOSHA sets forth for the employer, it's important to understand that there are general industry rules, there are construction rules, there's maritime rules, but all rules support the fact that we have to train our employees and recognize hazards that they may encounter during their scope of work. So that's a general rule across the board. Now, in some industries, such as general industries, we look at how many people do you have that works for this facility? And OSHA says that if you have 10 or more people, then you are required to have emergency action plans in writing. And then if you have less than 10 people, those rules can be verbal. So for example, Sheila, if you and I work together, we're the only employees, and something went down, you know, we could say, hey, call an ambulance if I'm experiencing a chest pain or something. But it's very specific, and these rules exist throughout all industries. But things like having a written emergency action plan is required. We talk about fire plans, exit routes, and procedures. We may also need an exposure control plan, depending on if our employees have a reasonable risk or exposure to blood or other types of body fluids. So, I'd be happy to work with companies and talk about what is it that they need, what do they need to have in place, because I'd much rather help an employer before something happens versus getting that call after something has happened and then try to figure out the gaps, what they didn't have in place, what they should have had in place that would have prevented that fatality.
And I see OSHA's getting a little more educated in that they're requiring safety and health management systems, which is what we have been talking about for many years, but now it's become an OSHA, my OSHA issue too, to have a written plan. And as you know, in construction, you have to have a written safety plan. It's available to the employees. Also, yeah. most places need a HAZCOM written plan. I'm sure we all have some kind of chemicals in the workplace. Can't get away from it.
So absolutely right. It's amazing when I go into places of business and we talk about the HAZCOM or Hazardous Communication Standard, you know, that falls under the 1910 or general industry rules, but it's those type of rules that are horizontal and exist in all workplaces. And it's amazing to me that these rules changed back in 2012, but we still have employers that have secondary containers without labeling or not the correct, you know, we used to call them material safety data sheets. Now they're safety data sheets that, you know, we should all be trained to know that section 4 is all about the first aid and response specific to that chemical. So yes, an employer is required to have a written hazardous communication plan.
I don't want to throw a curveball at you, but with all the things people have to be trained on, how what do you say when they say, how do I have time to train all my employees and communicate all this stuff that we're required to?
That's a common thing. You know, I think from the inception of OSHA, that was one of the negative communications that came back, was all this safety is going to cost us money. And how are we going to be able to sustain our business when we have to train all these employees and do all this, you know, put up barricades and create environments that are safe, you know? With history, that's what we got to look at. We can see evidence that supports that when you spend approximately $1 in health and safety initiatives, it's going to save your company approximately $4 in return. And how we break that down is we look at a cost of an accident. We look at a cost of a fatality or an amputation on the job. And we have issues like low employee morale or loss of productivity, but we also have lawsuits, increased insurance rates, and other things that stem from having a poor health and safety plan. So there is a lot of evidence to support that when we have a real defined emergency response plan, we train our employees, we equipped our employees with the tools to keep them safe on the job, that in reality, we're saving lives and saving money.
You know, that's a good point. With so many businesses looking for employees, if you've got a reputation for not taking care of your employees, like you say, the morale issue, you're not going to find good employees.
You know, I think that that's a hot issue right now, just coming out of, you know, this pandemic where a lot of employees had lost their jobs. There's a higher demand in fair worker wages, but I'm willing to bet that if we looked out to all these companies that have been able to retain their employees, they probably have a really well-defined health and safety program where they do provide training to their employees, you know, again, the resources to keep them safe on the job.
And how important do you think employee involvement is in not only anticipating emergencies, but training or being the trainers?
Well, you know, from the beginning, I talked about we all have to take personal responsibility for our own safety. You know, number one, when an emergency occurs, we need to make that it's safe for us to be there. You know, we need to look for downed power lines, spill chemicals, people with guns. But overall, I think the responsibility, it's an old cliche. You know, we have to go home safe at the end of the day. And when we're looking at 13 people on average die on the job, according to OSHA, that we still have some work to do in this regard.
What would you say to someone to convince them to work safely?
Well, you know, again, going back to that old cliche, going home safe at the end of the job should be everybody's first and foremost, should be a priority. You know, I wish more people thought about the things that they would miss, like vacations and visiting with family, if they were disabled or harmed or maimed in some way on the job. So I think that some of the takeaways or some of the things that we should look at is what can we plan for? What can we predict can happen here on the job? And even at our home, you know, when we think about home safety, do we have exits that are blocked? Do we have extinguishers that are ready to be used? I think that it's important to remind people that we only work for a short period of time, and the bigger focus should be on that time away from work. And if we get hurt on the job or we get overcome with gases and fumes, that it makes it awfully difficult to enjoy those things that really matter most to us.
You shared a story with me that you use in training about how you convince people with the, it's not about the money.
Right. Okay. So a common thing that I like to pose to my students, and I'm going to ask this group that's listening in with us today, I'm going to say, I'm going to offer you a job. And as a business owner, I have the opportunity to decide how much I'm going to pay you for that job. And for a lot of my students, especially my college students, this gets into a really unique conversation because I say, all right, I'm going to sign everybody up in this classroom and I'm going to pay you $500 for every hour that you work for me today. And I ask the group, I say, okay, who's in? And a lot of times they're like, yeah, whatever, you know, it doesn't matter, $500 an hour, you know, I'm going to do that. And the next thing I say, part of the commitment is that you have to die at the end of the day. And, you know, how lucrative, how good does that $500 an hour really sound to you now? And everybody says, you know, they're counting up the hours and they're saying, well, is it 10 hours? Is it 12 hours? But in reality, I think that we have a lot of employees that work for a lot less than $500 an hour that are taking higher risks for their employers to work unsafely. So we have to take that personal responsibility for our safety. And if we have the ability as an employer, as a safety manager, as a business owner, we have the responsibility to predict, to plan, and to communicate with our employees to keep them safe on the job.
Yeah, how important is being proactive? A lot of the things that we talked about have been a reaction to a situation. Then the rules were put in place, which is important. Right. So the idea is to try to get ahead of ahead of the risk.
Absolutely. And I often think about, again, I know I've talked about the World Trade Center in this podcast already, but there are so many lessons learned from that pivotal incident that happened in the United States, where so many people's lives were lost, that we can look and we can say, this incident happened the first time. And then, you know, the bombing in the garage. And then this incident happened September 11, 2001. And that is a clear snapshot and picture that we were able to plan, prepare. We had the buddy system in place there at the World Trade Center from the first incident, and lives were no doubt saved from practice planning and preparing. It was still a horrible incident, as you know, but I think that without that planning and preparation, a lot more people would have died that day.
Yeah, sure. And we've also mentioned the violence that's occurring in the workplace and in the schools and how the rules have changed for our children. Instead of preparing for a tornado warning, hiding under their desks, now they're training for an active shooter.
Right. It's
a different world that our children have to face.
It is. Businesses. And, you know, it's a fine line, especially when we're talking about children and emergency preparedness. I have two children, and I don't try to freak them out or make them have worry or anxiety about things that may or may not happen. But in the back of our minds, we always need to focus on being prepared of the what ifs. You know, what if something should happen? And, you know, as long as everything is running fine and as it should be on the job or at your home, then we don't have a worry or concern. But really what we're talking about today is the unplanned, the not normal incidents that makes us want to respond or react to that. And if we have no planning, no training, no preparation, I think that the outcomes are more grave for those folks.
So any final thoughts for me?
You know, I really appreciate this opportunity to come together and to talk about this important subject. I think that if I had a final thought is to, again, think about your own plans, whether it's in your workplaces or your homes. Think about situational awareness. If you're in a restaurant, a theater, or a community center, what are some things that could happen? And what are some ways that you can help protect yourself? And I really think that that's the key message that I want to talk about today, is that planning and preparing for emergencies is going to save a life, if not your own.
Yeah. Emergencies, disasters, catastrophes all have one thing in common. The extent of the damage may rely on anticipation, thoroughness, and the imagination of advanced planning, identifying and mitigating the risk whenever you can. So I would like to thank you, Tracy. You can contact Tracy at advancedtrainingconsulting.com. If you'd like to know more about this podcast or the safety conference, please contact us at MICH, safetyconference.org. And thank you so much for listening to Safety Spectrum.